Business Matters is proudly sponsored by Prince Supplies Frosses. With 21 years in business, Prince Supplies provides managed print solutions with local support and remote ink monitoring, saving your business time and money. Prince Supplies, your local printer and photocopier company.
Hello and welcome along to another episode of Business Matters with me, Chris Ashmore. Later in this week's programme, I'll be hearing about how the spike in oil prices will affect the cost of materials in the construction sector here. That is likely to mean even higher prices for everything from housing to major capital projects and even DIY jobs at home. And I'll also be finding out about how millions of euros worth of renewable energy is being generated each year, but being wasted when it could help to tackle fuel poverty and how surplus electricity could be put to much better use. But first, Social Entrepreneurs Ireland has opened its 2026 programmes for applications around the country. Social Entrepreneurs Ireland is a privately funded, not-for-profit organisation, and for over two decades it's played an important role in tackling some of the country's most complex social challenges. Unlike traditional funding models, it doesn't just back ideas, it backs the people behind them. And that means taking risks, staying the course, and ensuring no visionary leader is left behind due to a lack of support. Well, to find out more about Social Entrepreneurs Ireland and to hear one individual's own positive experience, I've been speaking with Gwydor-based David McCann. He founded the Sea Collective, an environmental outreach group that aims to inspire and empower people to act positively for marine biodiversity. David, thanks for joining me on Business Matters. In a moment, we'll hear, you know, how you have benefited from Social Entrepreneurs Ireland. But just that term, social entrepreneurs, what does it mean to you if you're talking to somebody about it?
Yeah, it's a great question, Chris, and thanks for having me on. When I think of a social enterprise, it's basically a business that is driven to have an impact either socially or environmentally or both. And I guess when we were setting up the Sea Collective 4 years ago, we found that that term and the concept was, I guess, relatively in its infancy in Ireland. And when we were reaching out to try and get support to help set up the Sea Collective, we were almost coming up against a brick wall because most people hadn't come across the term. So I think it's great to get it in there at the start of the conversation.
Yeah, now I was looking at the Social Entrepreneurs Ireland website and it says, to quote, as Ireland faces deep-rooted issues that traditional systems and government alone cannot solve, Social Entrepreneurs Ireland believes that solution lies in social entrepreneurs, courageous individuals who use their creativity and lived experience to design locally rooted, nationally scalable solutions. And, you know, that's a good way perhaps of summing it up. So tell us a little bit about now the Sea Collective and how you became involved, because you've been abroad, you've done a lot of travel, but you're now living in Gwydor.
Yeah, so my background, I studied marine biology in Ireland. I became a scuba diver and I've gained a lot of experience both locally and internationally in that sphere. And I found myself in Asia. So I was living in Malaysia and Borneo for 10 years. And while there, I set up a marine research organization. And at the time, we were kind of operating in our minds as a charity. So we were basically bringing money in through programs that we developed for businesses and for international tourists and using that money to fund our research and to fund our community programs. It was only actually after coming back to Ireland that I came across that term social entrepreneur as well and realized that actually that was what we were doing. We weren't a charity. Charities predominantly rely on grants, whereas a social enterprise would drum up its own revenue, I guess, and use that money to further its aspirations. We were based in Borneo. We were doing research on sharks. We had a turtle hatchery and a turtle hospital. We were doing underwater surveys on the health of marine habitats and implementing restoration projects as and when necessary. And the community of the island that we were based on were core to all of that work. So it wasn't that we were doing the work and they were separate to that. We co-developed all of our projects. So we looked at what are the issues facing the island, facing the communities, and how can we work together to develop solutions. To cut a long story short, after doing that for 10 years, we came back home during the pandemic. We settled in Gweedore. Our original plan was we would stay short term, and then when the pandemic was over, we would head back out to Borneo and pick up where we left off. But life has a way, I guess, of throwing curveballs at you. And we ended up joining a group of local sea swimmers, so a group of ladies from Gweedore and Clochaneely, calling themselves the Selkies. And my wife and I, as we were going for these swims, it turned out that a lot of the ladies in that group were either teachers or retired teachers or principals and so on. And when we were getting really excited about all of the things we were seeing while swimming, they suggested, well, why don't you go to some of the local schools and talk about this stuff? And I guess at the time it came as a bit of a surprise to us, because we kind of assumed that, you know, schools that have students looking out of their window at the shore, at the sea, they would already be learning about these things, but it turned out they weren't. And so we decided, well, why are we going back to Borneo to do this when it's needed at home? And so we went about setting up the Sea Collective. But I guess the challenge we faced at the time was we had gone through the process of setting up an organization in Malaysia. So we kind of knew what we wanted to do, but obviously the policies and procedures and so on in Ireland were different to those in Malaysia, and we were struggling to kind of get our head around those. And the Ideas Academy was invaluable to us in helping us to kind of navigate that and go from having a really good idea to actually operating. And here we are 4 years later.
Social Entrepreneurs Ireland has just opened its Ideas Academy and Impact Programme for applications. The deadline is the 20th of April. Now, you went on one of these programmes some years back. There might have been a little bit of tinkering of the programme since then, but tell us about your experience, because it was invaluable.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess when we were looking into setting up, we were looking for the kind of traditional support mechanisms. And we were finding that because we wanted to be a social enterprise, that we were not purely driven by profit, that this was about having a social and environmental impact, that the kind of traditional routes of getting support weren't actually available to us. So then joining the Ideas Academy, we realized we were surrounded by like-minded people, people who understood this mission, the kind of we were on. They had their own kind of ideas and issues that they were trying to overcome, but coming at it from a similar mindset to our own. So just being surrounded by people like that, you know, it gives you that kind of motivation and encouragement to keep going. It's also a group of people that you can bounce ideas off. And there were some absolutely fantastic expert-led sessions where they got you to delve deeper into the issue that you were trying to solve. So one of those that really sticks in my head, because like I said, we were coming to this from an angle of we've done this before, we know what we want to do, we need to recreate it and make it locally relevant. And that actually, in hindsight, was actually a hindrance as well, because although the issues can be similar in two different places, the reality of those two issues when you delve deeper is that they can be completely different. And so one of the challenges that was given to us by the Ideas Academy was to actually interview relevant stakeholders, so speak to people in our community and gather different perspectives, different ideas, and bring those into your idea. So you're basically spending more time understanding what the issue is before actually looking to see what the solution is. There's actually a famous quote that's often given to Albert Einstein, that if you gave him 1 hour to solve a problem, he'd spend 55 minutes understanding the problem and then just 5 minutes figuring out the solution. And I think that was one of the things that the Ideas Academy really got us to do. You know, forget about the solution that you already have. Go back to what the issue is you're trying to solve and understand that better, and that will then give you a more solid footing.
So the Sea Collective, what are the key objectives and aims, and what sort of geographical area are you confined or not confined to?
Yeah, so the Sea Collective is really about, I guess, bringing people together to celebrate our oceans, to improve our understanding of them through knowledge sharing. So that can be knowledge gained from, you know, an education from books, or it can be from local environmental knowledge. People who have gathered knowledge of their own local marine environment through a lifetime spent on it, or perhaps even more than a lifetime. You know, it could be generational knowledge that's been passed down. Also through implementing research programs. We're not quite there yet, but we will get there. This is the journey that you go on as a social enterprise, I guess. But ultimately what we want is we want healthier, more productive marine environments benefiting coastal communities. And I think that that works best when you work locally. So at the minute, we predominantly work in, I guess, the Northwest, but the same concept could be applied in other areas. But I think if the concept was applied in other areas, it would be better if that was being driven by people based in those areas rather than kind of the Sea Collective expanding.
Do you liaise with local businesses and those in the maritime sector?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, we have. So one of the things we talked about 4 years ago was having a big event that would celebrate our cultural, our maritime culture and heritage. And through a collaboration with the Irish Ocean Literacy Network, we're actually going to be holding an event in Cashlanoir on Thursday, the 23rd of April. So it actually worked out quite nice that I'm talking to you now. But that event is basically bringing local people with an interest in the marine environment together to celebrate our heritage and look forward to the future and kind of figure out, well, can we make our local marine environment work better for us as a community? And I believe that it's only by sitting down through dialogue and having conversations can we really then start to come up with solutions that could work.
Do you feel there is still considerable scope to create employment in coastal communities that may have declined in recent decades?
100%. The blue economy is kind of the buzzword that's around at the minute. It's rapidly expanding globally as well as nationally. And, you know, when I think of my own home area, so many of the families in this area would have relied on the ocean for sustenance, for jobs and so on. And a lot of people have kind of moved away from that. People have moved on to the land. People have moved into the factories and offices. But I think there's definitely scope to make that marine environment work better for the local community.
And obviously you have to get an income out of doing things. So are you constantly looking at sources of possible funding going forward? And are you very much dependent on programs like those through Social Entrepreneurs Ireland, or can you generate a certain amount of revenue just generically?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Ideas Academy was brilliant for getting us started. Actually, at the end of the Ideas Academy, there was an opportunity to pitch for some seed funding, which we actually took up that opportunity, and we were successful in it, so it was fantastic for us. It helped us to build a website and to get branded clothing and so on. But by and large, like with a lot of social entrepreneurs, you know, you're bringing money in through various means. So we would have a lot of our focus recently has been on our school programs. So we got onto the Heritage Council's Heritage and Schools program, which means schools can bring us in and we can go and talk to their students. We have a whole array of different ocean themed workshops. Whether it's, you know, sharks or whales and dolphins, or talking about issues facing the oceans, you know, like plastic pollution or climate change, or even recently we've put together a lesson that's about a loss of connection to the sea, so a loss of our sea stories, if you will. And this was a way of us of being able to offer programs to schools and making sure that the cost was not prohibitive, because they only have to make a small contribution. And the Heritage Council actually then pays the covers the rest. We are also there's the national program called the Marine Institute's Explorers Education Program. We also deliver that in Donegal. So that program is free to schools, or it's funded by the Marine Institute. And again, then we would get paid by the Marine Institute to deliver that. So you are kind of looking for, you have to get creative, you know, you have to think of different ways. But for us, the mindset is always the cost should not be prohibitive. That the cost should not discourage people from getting involved in the programs. So looking for government bodies or agencies or even funding pots that we can apply to pay for certain programs is something we're always on the lookout for.
And if somebody wants to find out more about the Sea Collective, what's the quickest way of doing so?
Yeah, theseacollective.ie is our website. We're also on Facebook.
And finally, you would certainly encourage people to look at Social Entrepreneurs Ireland and to look at those opportunities that are available now for the Ideas Academy and the Impact Programme with the deadline, the 20th of April.
Yeah, absolutely. We were very lucky, actually, when we found out about it. We literally found out, I think it was 24 hours before the deadline. But when we came across the opportunity, it was an organisation called The Wheel that highlighted it to us. We just thought, you know, this is too good an opportunity not to go for. So let's work all ours, get the application in and see, you know, if we can make it work. And we got in, and honestly, it has proven to be, it was a game changer for us at the time. We were starting to lose hope in terms of, do people not understand what it is we're trying to achieve? Is there nobody out there that can help us navigate, you know, how do we become registered and so on? Luckily for us, we got involved in the Ideas Academy and they certainly helped guide us through that process. So I would encourage anybody who has an idea for a solution to a social or an environmental issue within Ireland, definitely get your application in before the deadline. It's well worth it.
And that was David McCann of the Sea Collective based in Gwydir. Time now for a short commercial break. Join me again when I look at how to better use surplus renewable energy and also how construction costs could rocket due to the ongoing situation in the Middle East.
Business Matters is brought to you by Print Supplies. Based in Frosses, Print Supplies has 21 years experience delivering managed print solutions that save you time and money. With remote monitoring and local hands-on support, they take the hassle out of printers and photocopiers. Email sales@printsupplies.ie to find out more.
Welcome back. Considerable potential exists to make use of surplus electricity that has been generated by renewable energy sources such as wind. Indeed, there are times, especially at night, when Ireland can produce a sizable amount of electricity from wind turbines, but essentially some of it is going to waste. Well, that could all change. Energy Cloud is a not-for-profit initiative operating in England, Ireland, Germany, Northern Ireland and Scotland. Its mission is simple. Use surplus renewable energy, clean electricity that would otherwise be wasted, to support households in fuel poverty. To find out more, I've been speaking with its CEO, Alan Wiley. Alan, many thanks for joining us here on Business Matters. You're going to enlighten our audience about Energy Cloud and certainly very topical in the current climate. So first of all, maybe you can just explain in pretty simple, straightforward terms, what exactly is Energy Cloud, who set it up and what its chief aims are?
Great, Jenna. Thanks, Chris, and thanks for having us on today. So Energy Cloud, we're a charity and our vision is to end energy poverty. So that's what we're about. And it was set up a couple of years ago. And what we've been doing is working with our partners in county councils and approved housing bodies across the country to provide free tanks of hot water to those in energy poverty.
Now, Ireland, we hear sometimes people say there's scare stories that the network with all the data centers coming on stream, that we may have shortages of electricity in the future. We have to make sure we're generating enough. Yet at the same time, and even at the moment, we sometimes have a surplus of energy. And this is very key to what you're involved with. We are actually wasting vast quantities of energy, which could be put to better use.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the reason, I suppose, why Energy Cloud was first set up is the quantity of waste in the country is enormous. So last year, Chris, in 2025, there was €523 million of wasted renewable wind energy. So that's a huge problem, I suppose, and a huge cost to the country. But on top of that, there's 550,000 homes in energy poverty. So when you have an enormous amount of waste on one side and you have an awful lot of people struggling on the other side, then obviously it's an unacceptable situation that needs to be addressed.
In a county like Donegal, we have a lot of wind farms. We're in the wind farm league. I think we're in the top five. But one of the difficulties with wind energy is storage, that there is some degree of battery storage being developed in the country. But how does one sort of balance things to optimize the use of this surplus energy when it's available for the grid?
Yeah, so there's a couple of parts to answer that question, Chris. The first part is just to highlight that in the program for government at the moment, the government has committed to use surplus renewable energy that would otherwise be wasted to help those that are in energy poverty. But so far, over the last year or so, they have done absolutely nothing to start delivering on that commitment, okay? But without the commitment to use the waste, it's very unlikely that it will be used and the waste will continue to grow. So when you're in Donegal or other counties around the country, when the waste is in the system, you can, of course, store some of it in batteries, and that's part of the solution, perhaps. But you still have a very practical problem, because if nobody's trying to use it, it'll continue to be dumped. But even if you stored all of it, you don't have the grid infrastructure to move that energy to other parts of the country where the demand might be higher than it is in Donegal. So the real solution here is to actually try and use it in place, or at least use the energy that you can't move or store in place. So, for example, in Donegal, it says waste in the system. If the government wants to use the waste, then they could have a situation where you could distribute the waste in Donegal, and people in the night time, which is when the waste tends to happen on wind, between 11 p.m. and 8 a.m., that people in Donegal could have a cheaper tariff or actually have free electricity rather than just dumping it as we are today. And that would help decarbonize the grid as well, Chris, because now you take demand away from peak times and you move it to times when the grid is less busy.
And where do the electricity suppliers stand in all of this? Because does it mean they'll make less profit from generating the electricity as things stand?
No, I don't think so. I mean, right now, the electricity retailers are huge supporters of what we do. So they actually pay today for the energy that we give to the residents for free. So they're huge supporters of this. So there's no loss to them in this, because right now the electricity is not being generated and not being used. So they're not getting paid for it anyway. Whereas if we start using it, if anything, it's a better situation, because it reduces the waste and it's a more productive system, a less dysfunctional system, if you like, Chris.
Now let's move on to some practical examples. Shortly, you'll tell us about what's happening here in Donegal. But I know recently with SSE Electricity, you've linked up with them, and the Dunleary Rathdown Council, you've a project up and running there. What exactly is happening there?
Yeah, no, we do. SSE Electricity are a big supporter of ours. They give free electricity to our residents every month, which, as the other retailers do, which is great, very gratefully received by us and the residents. But they also donated €2.5 million to Energy Cloud to help us broaden out across the country. And one of the first projects we did with that money was in Dunleary Rathdown, which is where SSE are based. And they're very good partners with the county council there. So we're going to do about 450 homes in Dunleary Rathdown. But of course, we're right across the country, so we're just kicking off a pilot in with Donegal County Council as well. But we're in Mayo, in Roscommon, Longford, Galway, Kerry, Cork, Offaly, other parts of Dublin, and so on. So we are pretty much a nationwide organisation, thanks to the support of SSE and our other funders as well.
So if you work with local authorities, in practical terms, just what will the process be for people to avail of this surplus electricity?
Yeah, so we're a small charity. So right now we have to work through partners. So we can't work directly with individuals, unfortunately. As we grow, we hope to in the future, but today we can't. So we always work through partners. So if you're in social housing in Donegal, we're starting it in Inishowen actually. And if you're in a social house with Donegal County Council or an approved housing body, if we're working with that council, we'll speak to them. They'll pick the initial estates and so on for the initial pilots. And then we'll, as it goes forward, we'll hopefully roll out across the county. But at the moment, we're starting in Inishowen, and we'll hopefully roll out across the county in time, but through and in partnership with Donegal County Council.
So residents of these houses, they may get a case of getting a certain number of hours of electricity? And obviously you need a smart meter, do you, to be able to avail of things like this?
Yeah, well, not a smart meter in the ESB lingo, but what we would do is install, and we have different technologies, Chris, but the technology we're starting with is a smart immersion controller. So it replaces your immersion switch. And then when there's waste in the system, which is about 10 nights a month on average, we'll remotely access it, we'll switch it on, and you'll wake up to a free tank of hot water. And at the end of the month, then we'll send a report to your retailer to get you the credit. So that's how it works in simple terms. We're also doing pilots in other parts of the country with smart storage heaters, with heat pumps. So as we grow, the number of offerings will increase, if you like, Chris.
Now, I saw recently that the reports in terms of the number of people who are in arrears with their electricity bills, I think it was well north of 300,000. But you actually say in terms of people and energy poverty, it's more than 500,000. What do we define as energy poverty?
Yeah, so that is a great question. So there's a couple of things. Firstly, the numbers we quote to you, they're always the official numbers, so they're not Energy Cloud numbers. So the ESRI estimated a couple of years ago that there was 550,000 homes, which is about 1.5 million people, in energy poverty, and the ESRI defined it as spending more than 10% of your net income, your take-home pay, if you like, on your energy bills. Within that, of course, there's a stratification. You've got some people who are struggling a little bit and some people who are struggling a lot. And then just to explain for your listeners, there are over 300,000 people in electricity arrears. You're absolutely correct. But the reason why that is lower than the 550,000 is that if you're a prepay customer and you have a prepay meter, you can't get in arrears. So there's a massive number of people who are on prepay meters. They can't get in arrears. And a lot of other people simply switch everything off to save their electricity bills. And that's that awful phrase, they choose to eat rather than heat. And that's a very real problem. So that's the difference between your 300,000 and your 550,000.
If we compare ourselves to our EU neighbours, what's going on in other countries? Are we behind the curve? Can you give us examples of what's been done in other countries to use surplus electricity?
Well, in Ireland, we're not doing anything right now, so we're definitely behind the curve. But I think in other parts of Europe, so for example, in Germany, between North and South Germany, they've decided that they want to use the waste and the surplus that they have first before they start building additional infrastructure in place. So that's an example of people recognizing that you can't just allow the waste to keep growing unhindered forever. And to put that in context, in Ireland, in 2017, there was 50 million of waste. Last year, there's 525 million. And the main reason for this, Chris, is just a complete absence of political leadership. Because if the government said, no, we want to use the waste, it would spur on the different organs of government to actually start engaging and using it. So whether that's AirGrid, ESB, the Department of Energy, and so on. But without that political leadership, nothing ever gets done. And that's really where we find ourselves, why it's gone from 50 million to 525 million. And this year, it'll be worse again without that political intervention.
Now, I understand there is a body called the National Energy Affordability Task Force. Where does it lie in the whole equation? And is that going to be your friend in developing things as we go forward?
Well, look, we welcome any task force that's set up to try and action things, you know. But so far, there hasn't been much action from the National Energy Affordability Task Force. They call it NEAT. But there hasn't been any action so far. And actually, at the Joint Directors Committee on Energy in December, they clarified that their next report will be in July of 2026 with a view to the budget in October 2026. And I know things can move slowly in these things, but that does mean that nothing will be done on the waste and nothing will be done on energy poverty before the budget if we're relying on NEET. So we would say to the minister and to the people running NEET, it's too late. We can't waste another $500 million in surplus renewable energy while we're waiting for your report and the budget. There's no reason to wait for the budget. We can act now.
And why do you think it is that the government is so slow to act on this if it's essentially a win-win situation in the long term?
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it, Chris? I mean, I honestly don't know the answer. Obviously, inertia is part of it, which is that, you know, 8 or 9 years ago, it was a small problem, so they just ignored it, like a rounding error, if you like, when it was 50 million. Now it's 500 million. It's not a rounding error anymore, but nobody is actually grasping the nettle to try and fix it. And that's why we're calling for political leadership. But we've spent, like, I have met over 50 TDs and senators in Leinster House in the last 6 months, and we have huge cross-party support. We've been to 3 joint directors committees, unanimous support from everybody at those. It's an absolute win-win, as you say. It's a political open goal. There's really no downside to announcing this. The opposition would have to back it. The only thing you could complain about is, why didn't you do it sooner? But everybody would be delighted to row in behind this. So we really are unsure as to the slowness, the reticence to get going on this, other than people are busy and they have other priorities and, you know, they're just keeping their head down. It's inertia, really, Chris, we think.
So if we can fast forward or gaze into the crystal ball, be it 3, 5 or 10 years time from now, Alan, what would you like to see? What would be the ideal scenario in terms of how we optimise the use of this surplus energy?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Well, I think we should, if you take, and of course you're quite right, it depends on what time frame you take, but let's say if we took the lifetime of this government, so the next 4 years, I think it would be brilliant if the vast majority of this waste was now being used, and if it was being used to tackle energy poverty, as the Programme for Government says they'll do, you could have a scenario where in 4 years' time we've actually eliminated energy poverty. And in that case, Energy Cloud can pull up our tents and go home because the social problem is solved. And that might seem overly optimistic and naive even, but the National Economic Social Council, the government's own think tank, they published a report last year saying that the green transition is the opportunity to eliminate energy poverty. So we're not the only people who think this is possible, but it just takes action, Chris. So that would be my hope in 4 or 5 years' time, that the waste problem has been eliminated and energy poverty with it.
So you're going to be working with the likes of Donegal County Council. The hope will be that an increasing number of people in social housing will be able to benefit in some way from this surplus energy. What about people who own their own homes? Will they be able to avail of some of the surplus energy at a later stage?
With Energy Cloud, yeah, we would hope so. And we've done a couple of very small pilots with Age Friendly, with people who are in their own private homes. But the real solution for people in privately owned, and don't forget the poor people who are in privately rented accommodation and in energy poverty, is government policy. So reduced tariffs, targeted energy credits. That's how you really get to the privately rented and privately owned cohort. I think Energy Cloud can do something on that. But we say all the time, Chris, it's not about Energy Cloud. This is about energy poverty, and it's about government policy around energy poverty.
And finally, if people want to find out more about Energy Cloud, I take it your website's a good place to have a good look?
Yeah, energycloud.org, our LinkedIn page is pretty active and up-to-date as well. So, yeah, absolutely. And yeah, we'd be delighted to... If anyone who wants to support us, reach out to the local councillors or TDs, asking why the government is sitting on its hands. All help would be gratefully received.
And just one other question that springs to mind. Aside from the wind energy sector, I suppose we also have to take into account that there will be a growing number of solar farms, and there's other renewable sources of energy that can't provide that sort of guaranteed 24-hour supply. So this is going to be an area that no doubt you're going to be looking at as we venture forward.
100%. So we've started with wind because wind is at night, so you're unlikely to run into there's curtailments of wind also during the day, but most of it's at night, so you're unlikely to run into problems with peak times, whereas solar is all day long. Excuse me. So the waste in wind is about 11.5%. Solar is about 5.2 or something like that percent. So it's a huge problem for both. You're absolutely correct. And if you look at the experience of our neighbours across the border, their level of waste is about 22%. So I think you can see where this is going if there's not government action. But absolutely, it applies to solar as much as to wind.
And that was Alan Wiley, CEO of Energy Cloud. Finally, the wars in the Middle East are driving up fuel prices, and there is a direct knock-on effect for the construction industry. This raises issues for fixed contracts and much, much more, as Justin Malloy, the Construction Industry Federation's director of the Western and Midland region, has been telling me. Now, Justin, there are a pipeline of projects here in Donegal, be they privately financed or publicly financed. We can ill afford delays in investment in infrastructure, and the longer something is delayed, the more the cost is going to go up. So for people who are maybe thinking of buying their own home or building their own home or a company expanding, this is certainly a worrying time because it looks as if we're going to get price hikes.
Yes, it looks like there will definitely be some element of price hikes in it. But we would hope, obviously, and nobody knows, but we would hope that this would all be short-lived, that this thing would be resolved fairly quickly and the prices of fuel would come back, and that would be reflected in the cost of construction materials. This is nobody's interest. But, you know, we would be hopeful that that would be the case. But when you talk about infrastructure, particularly infrastructure projects and housing projects, I think we have to realise that I don't think we have an option other to keep on investing in infrastructure and housing, because we currently have a huge deficit in housing and we have a major deficit in infrastructure throughout the country. If you went back to the last downturn, we didn't invest in housing, we definitely didn't invest in infrastructure, and as a result, we're feeling the impact of that today. And we have, you know, we have an increased population. If you went back to 1975, I think Ireland had a population of approximately 3.5 million people, and we were building 28,000 houses a year. Today, we have a population of nearly 5.5 million people, and we're building 36,000 houses a year. And as we all know, there is a major shortfall in the amount of houses that are available out there. And we also, likewise, we know, and particularly in the Donegal region, you can see there's neither a railway track or a motorway up there. Like, it really, really lagging behind in infrastructure. And we know that from European statistics, when Europe is broken up, I think it's at 234 odd regions, in the northwest region is languishing somewhere around 17 from the bottom from an infrastructural perspective. So we know we have very poor infrastructure, and that we don't think we have the luxury of not investing anymore in infrastructure and housing. And I would suggest that the government would accelerate the delivery of this infrastructure as soon as we possibly could. And again, as I said, that we would avoid in these long protracted delays in our planning system that takes forever to get projects over the line and can be subject to appeals and judicial reviews and can go on for years. I don't think we have the luxury of that anymore. That costs everybody in the state money. It adds to it's inflationary, and it adds to delays, and it adds to the benefit for the people of the region. So we need to be a lot more efficient in the design, planning, procurement and delivery of our infrastructure.
And the rising fuel costs, obviously they impact on transportation. And when it comes to the manufacturing and construction materials, maybe a much broader area than people might think of initially. Everything from insulation to paints, coatings, adhesives, PVC, pipes, vinyl, and then, of course, the likes of cement and steel, they require an awful lot of energy to manufacture. So if electricity costs go up, those costs go up. So it's just a bit of a snowball, really.
It is. And again, it'll be crystal ball material to see how long this would go on, because it is. We're early on in this, and hopefully it won't go on for very long. But there's no doubt about it. Construction, by its very nature, is very fuel dependent, in that materials have to be transported to site, workers have to get onto site. So there's all, you know, those simple elements there that we're all using fuel to do that. But the manufacturing of certain products like PVC pipes, they're based, you know, use petrochemicals and all the rest for their manufacturing, as do a lot of other construction materials. And the manufacturing of cement obviously burns a lot of fuel into production of cement. So obviously it does all have an impact. But again, I would say we got to keep the increase in cost to a minimum where possible and ensure that whatever material prices are going up are justifiable and they're not more than what they should be, and that we're keeping these increases in materials to an absolute minimum for the benefit of everybody. And that, again, hopefully when this thing all subsides and the price of fuel goes back down, again, that these materials will go back in price as well to reflect all of that.
Away from the big projects, things like home improvements will also be hit. We've seen recently the SEAI announcing a range of new grants for making our homes more energy efficient. But again, the value of these grants may actually be less than what was intended for if there's an increase in the cost of the raw materials.
Again, that's probably true. I would hope that this wouldn't last long and that these increases, again, wouldn't last long. But even if they did, we have to, again, look at these projects and how we do them. Ironically enough, we still have a situation in this country, and we have prior to this crisis coming along, is that there isn't a pipeline of work for our construction workers here in this country. And despite, you know, you hear in the media quite a lot that we don't have enough construction workers, we're still sending an awful lot of our construction workers overseas. A lot of our civil engineers, mechanical, electric, and some of our larger general contractors have now all got operations overseas in mainland Europe and the UK, where they can see a greater pipeline of work. And that's, you know, kind of a folly here for the state here. We need to ensure that we keep our workers here, and then I go back to the all our infrastructural deficits and a national planning, the national development plan, and the need for a consistent pipeline of work to be delivered to the state so that we can keep our workers here. And the more workers we can keep here and the more consistency of supply of work and pipeline of work in here, the more it's easier for contractors to plan and for expansion of their businesses and taking on more people and controlling costs. But it's the sporadic nature of it, the stop-start nature of it, the uncertainty around it, that makes it difficult for contractors to plan for future expansion and growth in this country. So I think we have to address that. I think we can't just get bogged down in the current crisis. I think we have to wait. There's, you know, we can't control, obviously the state can't control what's gone on overseas and the price of a barrel of oil, but we can control, there's a lot of things that we can control, such as, I say, our planning system, our pipeline of work, and all those types of things. We could bring greater efficiencies in there, which would all help in the reduction of costs and expanding the industry for the betterment of everybody.
And worth mentioning that during COVID there was a spike in construction costs, then things settled down. So before the current crisis, I mean, if we go back over the last year up to, say, February, what was inflation in the construction sector in terms of costs? Had it levelled out?
It had. Well, a lot of it had levelled out. The large increases in construction materials that we had seen during the other previous crisis, they had kind of all abated a bit, and some materials were coming back in price. And there was kind of a stability, shall we say, getting into the market there again. And the difficulties, I suppose, we had prior to all of this was the lack of services-owned lands available for residential development throughout the country. That was, I suppose, that's what we're concentrating on, and then to ensuring that, you know, that we put in the services, that we ensure that the country addresses the major deficit in water, wastewater, ESB grid, etc., that we have all those basic services, and again, in our road network. And that's, I suppose, what we're trying to concentrate there, and that the government would, again, produce a pipeline of work, so that we could plan for the future.
And that was Justin Molloy, the Construction Industry Federation's Director of the Western and Midland Region, which includes Donegal. That's it for another edition of Business Matters here on Highland Radio. Can I wish you a healthy, happy and profitable week ahead? Until the next time, from me, Chris Ashmore, goodbye.
Business Matters is proudly sponsored by Prince of Plays Frosses. With 21 years in business, Prince of Plays provides managed print solutions with local support and remote ink monitoring, saving your business time and money. Prince of Plays, your local printer and photocopier company.